Welcome back to another episode of the Exterminatus Podcast. Once again, I'm your host, Eric.
I'm Raymond.
And this week, we've got a lot to cover. We had a light schedule when it comes to GT, but we had a ton of 40K news this week. Among those, we've seen our first glimpse into the new Eldar Craft World Codex. The community page was kind enough to show us a sample, and it sparked a huge amount of interest and discussion. It even divided your favorite co-hosts here on the podcast and how the news was received. We'll also talk about some of the missions we played. Ray got a chance to get an open war game in, whereas I got to try out the new ITC missions we talked about last week. And last but not least, the ITC top 10 have finally been updated. It's a huge shakeup at this particular point in the top 10. Can't wait to go over it. But first, let's dive into our GT of the last weekend. Ray, what was the name of that event?
The Endurance GT.
The Endurance GT, I believe, was in Kentucky again, correct? Jeffersontown?
That sounds right. I don't have that in front of me.
Got him. Right. So let's go over the Endurance GT. It was a pretty large event. Looks like about well over 45 players. Interesting, lots of ties, lots of mix-ups. So when we talk about the new missions a little bit, I'd be curious to see if those will be a thing of the past. But we start off with a three-way tie for 8th place. That's between Tim Hall playing Adeptus Auroratus, Andrew Hawkins playing Adeptus Astartes, and David Ivings playing Harlequins for the Bourbon Brothers Wargaming Club. All three of them went 3-2. In 7th place, we had Michael Ralston playing Orcs, also from the Bourbon Brothers Wargaming Club. He also went 3-2. He just eked out a few more points. And then we had a tie for 5th place between Glenn Barnett playing Dark Angels, as well as Ruben Fleming playing Cadian Shock Troops, also from the same club, the Bourbon Brothers Wargaming. Both of them went 3 wins, 1 tie, 1 loss. Again, a tie for 3rd place, Kevin Shack with Catechin Jungle Fighters and Ryan Hess with Death Guard, both of them going 3 wins, no losses, 2 ties. 2nd place, all by himself, was Jamie Grisby playing Officiato the Assassin's List. I still can't get that word out. Assassinorum? Officio Assassinorum. There we go. He went 4-1. And your overall winner for the Endurance GT 2017, playing Chaos for the Wrong Way Kids, John Marshall, going a perfect not only 5-0, but maxing out 19 points in every one of his wins, picking up a cool 127 points for his ITC rankings. So, interesting mix in terms of which armies are played, not an interesting mix in terms of clubs. So I guess you live in Kentucky and you're not part of the Bourbon Brothers Wargaming Club. You're in trouble. So well played, boys. Appreciate that. But looking at kind of the rest of the list, first of all, I got to make fun of there's a Maria Bowden from the same club. She only got one game in. But Morgan Card, he played Harlequins for the Bourbon Brothers Wargaming Club and went 1-4, so I guess that was a long ride home because all his other buddies made it to the top 8. But there seems to be a nice mix of players throughout the standings from that club.
So this tournament was a little bit interesting. And you know, we sit here talking about 2,000-point tournaments all the time. This one was 1,000. They were also using the Warzone Atlanta army construction rules, which I haven't actually had a chance to look at yet, but certainly makes for a different switch.
I'd be curious if they were using the Warzone Atlanta missions as well.
Actually, yes.
Aha. That would explain a lot. So those missions are very similar to the older Adepticon missions. There's a primary, secondary, tertiary, and any one of those three will involve killing, holding objectives, and then doing something like table quarters or kind of a basically a lot like the older 5th edition type missions. Similar, yeah. Why can't I think of these table quarters? Something similar to relics. Something similar to they're the older one. Yeah, I can't get my thoughts out today. Perfect for a podcast. Anyway,
another interesting thing is according to their description, it was judged by Games Workshop employees.
Well, that's
and
interesting.
place at a Games Workshop store.
Well, first of all, my hat's off to you because our Games Workshop store, as much as we enjoy shopping there, is the size of a broom closet. So when they have tournaments, if you're like, I think they can fit a max of 8 players.
Might also explain why it was 1,000 points, though.
That is true. So I know my first foray into 1,000-point tournaments was in Reading, the Berk Spring Assault. It's a fantastic event. It's also a charity fundraiser. They play 1,000 points, but it's also 4x4 tables. So it really had to very different meta and very different gameplay in terms of that. But it's also a lot of fun because you get a lot of players for, maybe that's their first foray. Getting 1,000 points together for tournament level is a lot easier than scraping together 2,000 points. So maybe that's what was going on. But overall, first of all, I'd like to see orcs in the top eight. So glad to see that. A lot of people are down on orcs. We were just talking about a mutual friend of ours who is dropping out of playing orcs. And, orcs for an index army are extremely strong. I'm just really surprised by that. You got Adeptus Sororitas, which we've talked about at length. Nice to see Dark Angels. We've seen a lot of Space Marines, but curious to see what, Dark Angels are playing a pure list, or is it a Imperial Soup with a little bit of Dark Angels? Starting to see some of the new, Cadian Chock troops, Cadogen, Jungle Fighters instead of just Imperial Guard. So mixing and matching a little bit. Are you able to pull up any lists from this event?
Yes.
All right.
So the Dark Angels one you were curious about.
Yes, please.
It was a spearhead detachment
Ah, so okay.
consisting of Azrael, a Primaris Ancient, three squads of Hellblasters, all with the Assault Plasma Incinerator, and two Las Cannon Razorbacks.
Okay, well, that's where some of the firepower is coming from. For a 1,000-point list, that's a lot of heavy shooting. Interesting. Okay.
I'm curious about the Razorbacks. I mean, why would you take two Razorbacks when, I mean, they're not really dedicated transports for anything. You can't put the Primaris Marines in them.
I was just about to say something and I caught myself originally say, oh, they're troop choices, wouldn't they be objective security? But you're right, they're dedicated support choices. So originally I thought that was like his backline protection. He parks them both on a probably an objective. He's got the las cannons, which give him range, being a vehicle, being probably what, toughness 7 or something, 3+ with a dozen wounds, give or take. It's a little more durable than attack squad, but you're right, you don't. Their dedicated transport. I don't know.
But it is, in fact, purely Dark Angels.
I'm glad to hear that. Well, not bad. We got him 5th place. What other lists do we have to chance to preview from this fine event?
Take your pick.
Let's look at the orcs, Michael Ralston's list.
So we've got, unfortunately, the type of detachment is not listed because it got cut out. But we've got a big mech.
Which is
Got a weird boy. And lots of Gretchen.
really?
And then a red herd. Looks like two of them. Three of them. Two Defcoptas. And another unit of Gretchen.
So he's probably playing for board control, sounds like. Interesting.
So one, we've got 7 units of Gretchen. Each one of them is 30. So major board domination if he keep them alive.
Very, very interesting. Okay.
Let's see. John's? Mr. First Place? Oh no. He went anti-fluff.
Anti-fluff? So, oh.
He brought Magnus and Mortarion.
How is that possible?
The,
It's alright.
The... I keep forgetting the name of that one, but there's a... It's a super heavy command attachment, I think it is, where you it's just the three Lords of War, and you can have an HQ choice, and I think you can have an elite choice, too. So Magnus, a Malefic Lord. Something got cut off. Mortarion. So I'm thinking he might have had either... Okay, they're Pink Horror units. Because it's listed... what they are is cut off, but it's got the split rule for both of them, so I'm assuming, yeah, they're both pink horrors. Or at least horrors of some sort.
So nothing too out of the ordinary, kind of your typical chaos soup of late, but okay.
I'm kind of surprised that they were able to fit all that in without a 1,000 points.
Yeah.
But
yeah, I agree with you there.
Let's see... You know what I'm kind of curious about would be the Catachan one. Let's take a look at that.
Sure.
After all, this is a fairly new new codex.
Right, so he's going to be looking to maximize all the flamers and other weapons that have D6 shots or 2D6 shots. And curious to see what he's got.
This is how it's listed. We got Iron Hand Strachan, a company commander with Relic Blade of Conquest, company commander with Relic Mammorph Tuskblade. 5 infantry squads.
Wow.
With Melted Gun and Power Sword.
Okay.
1 infantry squad with Flamer and Power Sword.
There we go.
Gunnery Sergeant Harker. Ministorum Priest with Chainsword. A Commissar. 3 Scout Sentinels with Heavy Flamer.
There we go. Okay.
3 heavy quad launchers with 3 crew each. That's 1,000 points.
So he's got the quad launchers for long range. He's got the guys with flamers. So he probably puts the flamer guys, venture squads, to be his objective holders. So if giving them a counter charge. He's got the melted guys to go tank hunting. And he's got the 2 sentinels to kind of contain the opponent in their own deployment zone.
See, you want to hear the crazy part?
Sure.
That's a battalion.
In 1,000 points. Yeah. Uh-huh. Welcome to Guard.
You know what the funny thing is? It says battalion, but I think he means the brigade one, the one where you get 9.
Well, he would need, you got 3 troop choices, you would need 2 of each, right? 2 heavies, 2...
No, I believe he needs 6 troops, minimum.
Oh, you're right, I'm getting battalion and brigade mixed up.
Yeah.
But I remember with brigade, it was all the other, I mean, you need like 2 elites, 2 heavies, 2 fast.
But, and he got that.
Yeah, he's got that, maybe it is, wow.
Which, I mean... I'm actually more surprised he didn't end up in like first or second, but granted, when you consider what's in first, I mean, he's probably gotten double, if not more, what most people had for command points.
Well, let's see here. He lost to Jason Grisby and Ty Glenn Barrett. Jason Grisby, Glenn Barrett, actually, he ended up tying him later. And they both, yeah, they tied each other in round 4, and they both maxed wind on round 5, so they both tied it for 5th place. And Jamie Grisby came in 2nd.
Yeah.
So.
He did bring assassins.
Right. Interesting. Right. So, yeah, he came close. Just looks like he had that one game get in the way.
Yeah.
All right.
Okay.
All right, so that's all our tournament coverage for this week. Like I said, kind of a light week when it comes to tournament talk, but let's get into our discussion about the latest preview of the Eldar Craft World Codex.
Hi,
right, so it was once again thanks to the Warhammer community page, one of the greatest resources of 8th edition, one of the nice changes that Games Workshop has reintroduced himself to social media. So we had a small drop over the weekend, and let's start with that because it addressed some of our previews that we talked about on last week's episode. And one of those in particular was the fate of the Inari. Ray, what do you remember from that little announcement?
So if memory serves, they announced that they were bringing them out in an updated package. I don't remember it actually specifying whether they were each going to be in their own package or if it was just a repackage of the Gathering Storm box that they came in. But they announced that that's where you'll be getting the rules for playing Inari as a faction.
So, absolutely. It's just the Inari, so you have to buy all three at once, and the rules will be packaged inside of the former Gathering Storm Triumvirate. What we don't know is, unfortunately, is that just the index rules? Are these new rules? What's changing? What's not changing? No idea. We just know whatever the rules are, they're in the packet.
We also don't even know whether or not they'll have even just posted up digitally by itself. Something this small, one would hope they would. Otherwise, everybody who's bought Inari up to this point is going to be kind of pissed.
Self-included here. So, yeah, I would be pretty annoyed to have to buy a whole new pack of and try and sell the models just to get the rule set. That'd be kind of annoying. On the good news, though, they did announce that the plastic Eldrad that came from the Deathmass box will finally be sold separately, so you don't need to find it. Because that Deathmass box, by the way, is completely out of stock. So if you see it on a second-hand seller as such as eBay, grab it. It's not available anymore from Games Workshop. So it started off, and we're like, okay, that sounds interesting. Gave a couple ideas of what's going to happen. And then Monday morning came, and we've dropped our first hint at what things look like, and Craft World Iandan was previewed on the community page. And the first thing that made me cringe was, for the first time since 8th edition dropped, the website was just avalanched with negative comments. Just people screaming and hollering, this is overpowered, power creep is back. I was going to play something else. I'm glad I still have my Eldar. Or just a lot of people are like, I knew they wouldn't, Games Workshop wouldn't keep Eldar weak for too long. And just venomous hate all over this particular release. And I'll be honest with you, this is where Ray and I disagree a little bit. I don't think it's justified. My first cringing thought is, please don't piss off Games Workshop. This has been a great resource. If they turn off their social media feed again, I don't want to go back to those dark ages. But on the flip side, relax and read through it and actually build a list and try it. A lot of what they talked about isn't all that powerful, especially when you put it into context of the army itself. But Ray, you had different thoughts.
Well, when it comes to the people's reaction, I did think it was overblown. Something I've noticed with a lot of these codexes that have come out, because, let's be honest, I've bought more codexes this edition than I've bought in the past two editions. When it comes to the, you know, in this case, they're going to be called Craft World Attributes or Legion Tactics or, you know, whatever they decide to call it, the tactics you've given for being a particular group in the from the Codex, a lot of them are getting reused from Codex to Codex. We've had the -1 to hit when you're 12 inches away in three Codexes. What we see here in the craft in Iandans is a reuse. It's being reused, at least partly, from the Guard. I don't actually remember which one off the top of my head, but I do remember that one of them had part of this. Another part, where it comes to the wound counter. The other part, which is the never losing more than one model, if memory serves, is actually from the AdMech Codex, and one of those ones.
So those who haven't seen the posting yet, let's kind of go over what we're talking about here. So the Craft World attribute, as Ray stated, is sort of the Eldar Craft World version of Chapter Tactics. And so for Ayandan, they have what's called Stoic Endurance. A unit with this attribute can never lose more than one model as a result of a single failed morale test. So as we mentioned, I believe there was an ADMAC, but I always associate that ability with the Commissar.
Yeah.
In addition, if a unit with a damage chart has this attribute, double the number of wounds actually has remaining whenever you're consulting the chart to determine its characteristics, which I believe was Mordian, I think, had that in Imperial Guard. So off the bat, like I said, we're recycling some of our ideas, which is okay. Redundancy makes it easier to remember the rules and apply them back and forth. So, but a lot of people started to kind of flip their lid a little bit and talking about, wow, these guys are incredibly resilient. And especially when they read the next sentence and the next little preview that they gave up, and that's where people really lost their lid. And that is that the Wraith Guard, Wraith Blades, and Wraith Lord, so the smaller infantry models and these larger monstrous creature, all got a plus one toughness. So Wraith Guard and Wraith Blades are now toughness 6, and Wraith Lords are now up to toughness 8. And at this point, people were just freaking out, thinking like, oh my god, a Wraith Lord's more is tougher to kill than Mortarian. I just looked at, what? What are you talking about? So let's dive into that a little bit deeper. So right off the bat, yes, toughness 6 sounds pretty nasty. It's a 3-wound model, by the way, with a 3-up armor save. But let's put this in perspective. When you're playing Ayandan, and if you're sticking to the kind of Ghost Warrior theme, these are expensive units. This is a highly elite army. And just 2 weeks ago, we were saying elite armies are not successful because there's too many armies like Astra Militarum with tons of bodies that can just blow you off the table. So at toughness 6, it's not like it used to be in previous editions. Toughness 6 means, okay, if you're a strength 3 weapon, you're now wounding on 6s instead of 5s. That's significant. I'm not going to put that into the slough off column, but I want to look at how many armies do have strength 3 weapons as their main gun. I'm only looking at like Astra Militarum at this point and las guns. Bolters at strength 4 are still at wounding on 5s. Nothing's changed. Second thing I'll bring up was before we get to the Wraith Lord, because that is significant, is this Mortarian comment. Still no after save, so most people refer to it as a feel no pain save, although they barely use that in this edition. You know, there's no, okay, if you fail a wound, you can roll a 5 or a 6 and you don't suffer the wound. None of that's mentioned here. You know, there may be a psychic power down the road, but definitely nothing built in. So these army, although very elite, is still very prone to smite and smite spam. So I'm not feeling that Death Guard are, you know, in danger of being the toughest army in the galaxy to Ayandan. No way. Smite spam is real. It's out there, and it does quite a bit of damage. And I think as a Wraith player, you're going to be in a little bit of trouble if you don't have an answer to that. Now, with the Wraith Lords going to toughness 8, you may have a point, because that means both bolters and las guns, there's a lot of strength 4 out there, are wounding on 6s. So they can slough off a fair amount of small arms fire. The doubling your wounds when it comes to the damage track, you're right, that gives you about 3 extra wounds before you degrade. It's a 12-wound model. Normally after 6, you drop down to Blitzic Skill 4. Now you got to drop down to like 4 wounds before, or excuse me, 3 wounds. And you'll be down to 6, and then you actually start dropping. So, yeah, they're a little stronger. But when I look at what's on, you know, usually your Wraith Lords, you're looking at 2 heavy weapons. I tend to put Star Cannons on mine, but you're free to choose whatever you want. You've got the Glaive, and you've got probably a Flamer just to be counter-assaulty. So I look at that and I go, hold on a second, let's actually build a list. And then when you run out of points really, really fast. So it's nice to see that the elite armies are going to be able to hang in and not just mow down by volume of fire. And by elite army, here's what I've been running. Just as It's not maximum optimized, but when I looked at this for tonight's discussion, three units of Wraith Blade and/or Wraith Guard, kind of mixed and matched, really didn't see much of a difference. Point values: two Wraith Lords, a Spirit Seer, followed by a second detachment of three units of Guardians and a Farseer. And then, oh, by the way, for the Wraith Guard, because they're still, by the way, movement 5 inches, so they're pretty damn slow. Put Wave Serpents in each of those lists, bare bones. And these are only 5-man squads of Wraith Guard. That's not a lot of models on the table. So, it's still, and it's not really overpowering on the Psyker table. There could be a little bit here and there that you can do. So, I think some of this is a little overblown.
Question.
Sure.
On your for the Guardian, you have Guardian Defenders, you said?
Yes.
Okay. Did you give them any heavy weapons platforms?
No.
Okay.
No.
So I think, granted, we haven't seen any of the other four. It's day one. I do see that this could be a powerhouse, but I don't think that someone who wants to maximize this is going to go very heavy on the in the Wraith Guard or the Wraith Blades. They're going to focus a little bit more on things like Guardian Defenders, where they can maximize the ability to use as many as possible to make basically span the groups out. Where we'll see them focus will be a Wraith Knight. Maybe a couple Wraith Lords. The items, the ones that are that can use the guns for better range. They won't need to get as up close. If they feel the need to get up close, they may decide to have a Wraith Serpent for or Wraith Serpent for the Guardians, or maybe one or two units of Guardians. We'll see that utilized more than the race side, with the exception, of course, of their super heavy.
All right. We'll see. I kind of disagree with you still, because but then again, we haven't seen the rest of the book. Because one thing they talked about both in the weekend release as well as today's release is the relic for Iandan, which is the Psychotrone of Iandan. And short version is, if you're within range of it, which I believe is only 6 inches, I don't have it up in front of me, it doubles the number of attacks in the fight phase. So that gets pretty. So they talk about an example. For example, the drastically reduced Spirit Seer, which is now down to 45 points. He triggers the Psychotrome of Iandan and throws guided Wraithsight stratagem on a group of Wraith blades, and just talks about how devastating that is. And everybody kind of lost their lids again. And they go, well, wait a minute. The relic is a one time only per game. And then command points when they are at a premium. Every list I was playing. Now, maybe your method, maybe that's a way around it. But every time I couldn't get more than seven, maybe six command points, which means a lot of these stratagems are at a premium. You're not going to be doing them round after round. So it was, again, another one of those. Let's put this into context. Whereas, say, Imperial Guard, we talked about last week, you can easily rack up 15, 16 command points. And by the way, you have orders on top of your stratagems. So it's a little different.
So when I saw the one command point stratagem for the guided Wraithsight, that's exactly what made me lean towards the idea of Wraith constructs sitting there and shooting from a distance.
Me just read that for the group because I think you got a good point there. So as mentioned, one command point. Use the stratagem at the start of your turn. When you do so, pick an Iandan Spirit Seer from your army. Until the end of the next turn, the range of the model's Spirit Mark ability is increased from 6 inches to 12 inches. So if you don't remember, that means it allows all Wraith Construct to reroll ones to hit. This ability allows Iandan Wraith Constructs units to reroll all failed to hit rolls instead of just ones. So go ahead.
I
I think
think
you're right. That might be a really powerful tool.
so yeah, I see someone sitting at a fairly decent distance. Not too far, not too close, but they're gonna have a spirit seer right smack in the middle in between two wraith lords, and they'll have their wraith knight out doing whatever they feel like you're gonna do with it. But and what as long as it's in that formation, it is almost impossible to ever actually be closer to the spirit seer than you are to the wraith lords. Just because of the size of the bases. Even if you're based, unless you're base to base, you wouldn't be able to do something like smite it, or shoot at it, unless of course it's you've got a sniper rifle or some other way to, bypass the character rule.
One thing you bring up a good point, and I'm starting to come around to your line of thinking here, is you can then bubble wrap that fire base with all the guardian squads you talked about. Because
Actually,
unlike guard, there isn't a commissar character that can be sniped out to keep them from running away. They
exactly.
have it built in. So, good point.
Eldar have been a powerhouse. I mean, as long as I've played, which would mean start of six, after not long after their codex came out. It's definitely important that GW keep them under control to a certain extent. I'm not worried that that's going to be a big problem, but I like the idea of every codex having this one group that really stands out. Like, this is the one you want to go if you really want to maximize your ability to fight. And every time we see one people doing more than one and doing well, that just makes me feel better about it. I'm not going to count Yunari when it comes to craft roll because, well, they're not going to be part of the codex. But there's one person in our gaming area where he brings Ulthway, which is tomorrow. And, that's one that at least in the most recent past has had units that kind of stuck out, at least to an extent.
True.
So it'll be interesting to see what one or multiple other craft worlds really stick out for people.
Yeah, I'm excited for Ulthway tomorrow because that was always the one that I kind of gravitated to, but more so for their webway portals. I remember when they first came out, they had those little, it was like a piece of war gear. You put it down on the table, and then all your infantry and light vehicles, mostly your war walkers, could come out and kind of deploy from that point. It was a really cool effect. I liked it a lot. So curious to see if they bring that back. It'd be kind of neat. Just to keep everybody up to date as well, it seems like they also previewed one of the psychic powers, and they brought back, at least for the Runes of Battle, which I believe were the Spirit Seer Warlock powers, the double powers. So each power has two different effects you choose. And the one they showed off today was Empower and Invenerate, which I didn't know was a word, but I learned something today. Both go off on a six. Empower, choose a friendly Asuriani infantry or Asuriani biker. So sorry, any allies, only the Craft World guys. Within 18 inches of the Psyker, add one to two wound rolls in the fight phase for that unit until the end of the next psychic phase, until your next psychic phase. Boy, I rambled that badly. So plus one the wound is pretty nasty and pretty much needed when you're sissy slap fighting with strength three. And then Invenerate, the other option is you choose an enemy unit within 18 inches and they subtract one from their wound rolls during the fight phase. So take that, Khorne Berserkers. So kind of neat. Six isn't particularly hard, but not particularly easy. But correct me if I'm wrong, 18 inches seems very long range for psychic power.
I've noticed 18 seeming to be kind of a fairly common number when it comes to these psychic powers. Something I've noticed is when it comes to casting, 18 comes it seems to have become somewhat common, while the ability to deny is becoming very common at the 24 range. So you have to be
Yeah.
closer to cast and you have to deny. And a lot
which
of
is where I think maybe Eldar may have their secret sauce somewhere in some piece of relic that they may be better at denying some of the other armies at casting their own psychic powers. So not only can they get their powers off, but they can block you from casting your powers. I haven't seen it yet, but we'll see what happens.
something I'm interested to see is, will GW say that enervate and empower are considered to be the same? I mean, are they the same power for the purposes of casting more than one spell?
That's a very good question. So my gut instinct would say yes, they are, because they're on the same card, but I could see rules as written. I did not cast Empower, I casted Enervate, and I'll cast another power. Not sure. I just think if a game mechanic system is as you have your deck of cards for your psychic powers, and you discard as you play, but it really doesn't say that in the rules anywhere. So,
Something that the Elder Powers have always made me think of are the old double cards that Magic the Gathering used to have, where if you looked at the back, it would be one card, but when you looked at the face of it would show two cards on there. I hope that they kind of take that as a, this is a single power, it just has two different versions, two different names, but the same power. I really hope GW comes out and says that. Otherwise, instead of them getting, 6 to 12 powers, depending on whether or not they get two different, branches of powers like they have in the past, we'd be looking to closer to 12 to 24, which would blow things way out of proportion to what they've been doing.
true. So we know from the last codex that only the warlock slash spirit seers had the double choice. The far seers had had pretty much your favorites, doom and guide and foreboding and all those fun stuff. So it's curious to see what they come out with. But I mean, it's another interesting to see moving forward. We're used to having to roll randomly for your powers now that you can choose. Definitely curious to see how this all plays out in terms of designing list building and affecting the meta.
Now, that being said, if you guys are out there and you have an issue with the Codex of Craft Worlds, that's fine. But how you go about expressing your problems can make a di big difference between whether you see an FAQ that kind of helps balance everything out, or whether you see GW just kind of decide to back away from, their Facebook page and this and that. It's important to do things in a constructive manner, not a destructive manner.
Yeah, please do. I don't want to lose this conduit. It'd be really nice, and this is exactly the sort of thing that kind of drove them away. So,
What
one
other
other
thing
thing
to
to
look
look
at?
at? You asked me earlier, Ray, and I never answered because I want to save it for the show. Predictions for the rest of the Codex.
Where to begin? Let me double check. We've got four other craft worlds to do, and I don't remember seeing the actual names. You knew Iandon and Ulthway were going to be big ones for sure, but where are the other ones?
So one I can think of right off the top, because you're better at the lore in the background than I am. BL10 has been fractured, so are they still in the rulebook? Are they still in existence, or?
I do remember them being on the list. Unfortunately, the list I saw was this morning, and I think due to, you know what? One moment, please.
You're doing what I'm doing.
Probably. The internet at our fingertips, then what do? We stare at one screen.
Got it. I just couldn't do it fast enough. Got it. Okay. So
Looking at
looking
the
at the
previous
previous
post
post
from
from
the
the
weekend.
weekend, contains rules for the Ulathe, Iandon, BL10, so it may be fractured, but you can still play it. Altioch and Samhain. So curious to see. So let's kind of go through Ulathe. Like I said, I remember them. What did I say?
You like to move the vowels for some reason, dude.
Yes, I do. That's why I lose at Wheel of Fortune. My
Fair.
wife has this incredible ability. She's like, it'd be like a puzzle, like, just a myriad of letters. And it's Pat Sajak. The category is event. And then she's like stares at it. At least once a week, she'll go, Washington crossing the Delaware. It's like, they didn't even call the letter yet. How did you figure this out? anyway.
Ulfway. So, Ulfway, Beltane. I think Samhain was one of them, wasn't it?
Correct.
Yeah.
So basically, the Jetbike guys, the Ranger guys, the Aspect Warrior guys, the Dead guys, and the Webway guys.
Yeah. I honestly think that we're going to see them utilize that. You said Ulfway was pretty big on the Webway. I could really see them having an ability to where a lot of their units can just pop on the field. They might even give them a bit of a Raven Guard, like where you know you've got the 12 inches or further minus one to hit, along with and they may just decide to give them the stratagem of being to jump on the deep strike basically with whatever units they want to. But I think that's the route they're going to go there, something along the lines of that. Like what we saw with Raven Guard. I'm not really too familiar with the Beltanes. Which of the kind of strategies would you describe Beltane as?
Beltane is the ones that uses the most Aspect Warriors.
Okay.
And the old formation was a Court of the Young King, where you get one of each Aspect Warriors and the Avatar. So how do you create that into stratagems? I'd be really curious to see this.
Yeah, that would be a good one. You know, I don't know there. We may see something completely new for that one.
I'm going to just take a look while you're talking, see if Aspect Warrior is actually a keyword or not.
Yes, it is.
All right, so there you go. So then maybe that's how they do it. Their stratagems are you may play this on a Beltane Aspect Warrior, so you're not roped into playing, I just have to play only my Striking Scorpions are good, or only my Swooping Hawks are good. You can play this. That'd be interesting to see.
That'd be something pretty cool. It's nothing but Aspect Warriors, basically. Yeah. That'd be really cool.
Yep. Altioch is...
Go ahead.
Yeah, I hope I pronounced it right. Altioch is the Ranger one.
Oh, Alatok.
Alatok. Okay.
Okay, Rangers. I could definitely see them doing some Ranger focus. They might have something that gives them, you know, just maybe plus one to hit. But I think what we'd really see there might be something along the lines of the Guard. And I think we could see something for the Guardians specifically. Because, there's going to be Rangers, but I don't think they're going to focus too hard on something that just flat out comes with sniper rifles. I think that would probably be the wrong route.
I just hope they don't bring back the old disruption table. That thing was annoying. It wasn't particularly fluffy, and it was particularly annoying to play against and for with. So basically you rolled on a table on a 2d6, and something happened to your army. I was like, ugh. Okay, and some of it could be as simple as you lose turn one, and some of them were extensive, like, fast forward to the rules today, D3 units suffer D3 mortal wounds to start the game. I was like, what? What is this nonsense? So
yeah, I think if they're smart, they'll avoid that route.
That was really, really, really annoying. And then the last one, although they're not my favorite craft world, I'm most curious to see these guys because I like to play lots of jet bikes with my Drukhari. But Samhain and the Wild Riders, you know, they are known for all their jet bikes. So I'd be curious.
I could definitely imagine them doing something to focus on jet bike, the jet bike keyword. At the same time, I do remember that they are biggest when it comes to fighting other factions. They're the most warlike. So we could see things like, you know, I could see them doing a reroll against something like Chaos, where you can reroll to hit Chaos or Imperium or both. Because in the Flub, that's their big thing, is they're trying to fight the humans, basically. They are the most warlike of all of them. And the Fluff, Ulfway, mostly thanks to Eldrad, he's really more of the moderate, you know, let's work together. The people of the Samhain were the opposite of that.
That's interesting. I didn't know that. Yeah, I could definitely see that then. Yeah, I kind of assumed that'd be like some sort of jet bike bonus, is what I'm trying to say. You know, like a minus one to hit, or a re-roll advances, or something or like that, or they can move and shoot without penalty. What you're describing there is actually a little more interesting and a little more depth. That would be really cool. So we should know by our next week's episodes, because they five craft worlds, 5 days of the week, and we've already gotten one on Monday. So very exciting.
Of course, that gets released. That's out for pre-release this weekend, according to the announcement. So, you know, won't be too much longer. And we still have not heard what the last two codexes of this year are supposed to be.
We have not. Oh. They did announce the Tyranid Codex. We know that for sure. But the way they announced that way back at Nova, so no surprise there.
In fact, some people, I was laughing because if I remember right, they announced the release date for Tyranids was announced before the release date for the Eldar, and the Eldar are coming out first still.
Correct.
So up there. It's been under a rock. The 4th of November is pre-release for the Tyranids, and the week after that's when the Codex comes out. That's all we know for Tyranids so far.
And we got a nice picture of a poor Eld. It looks like a Skitari trying to hold off a Hive Tyrant by himself. It's pretty funny. But that's all we have at this point. So as Ray mentioned, there are still two more codexes to come out this year. Don't know what they are. I have not heard any new rumors, and I don't think you will. I think one thing I've noticed about 8th edition is the rumor mongers. You can tell which ones were the real rumor mongers and which ones were not. Because the real rumor mongers who got really good information and were close enough to GW, I think GW reached out to them and say, I'm willing to work with you as long as you keep your mouth shut.
I think I could argue that being a rumor monger means you're not necessarily right. If you're telling the truth all the time, what you are is a mole, whether or not you're being told to do it on purpose, because you know already.
Yeah, like one I could tell, because it was an interesting way he gave his explanations. It sounded like he worked in the company that made the packaging for the box sets. Because he was able to describe models, he never had information about rules, and he would always have to describe so he knew a lot about twin packs and stuff like that. So it was like, that was very interesting. And then you have the other type of rumor mongers that are like, I got a friend who works at GW and they tell me this, which you still see a little bit of those, but it's always, you never know where that is in the pipeline.
Yeah.
And of course the last ones, which are always the most unreliable. I went down to my local GW store and the red shirt told me X.
And that is the most common of them all, too.
True. And which is funny, because I know our local red shirt, he just laughs at us. He's like, I don't know anything. He waits for us to tell him the rumors. So
I really think he probably knows more than all the other ones. He's just not much better at hiding it.
Probably, but I think also it's just a matter of, you know, what's the timeline and stuff like that. I think when it comes to marketing, they want to keep you hyper focused, so they're not going to give you a whole lot of leeway in thinking ahead. But anyway, we've gone on off our tangent. Other discussion for this week we wanted to talk about is both Ray and I got some games in this week with alternative missions. Ray, you got a chance to try out the Open War deck.
Yeah. So I played one of the guys who not only frequents the game shop, he also actually works there. His name's Adam. He's a guard player. He's not huge in playing the actual tournament ITC stuff. He has played, but he likes to go with the more random things. He picked up the Open War cards, and Actually, they're kind of fun. So first off, the deployment we had wasn't really too special. It's your basic, I believe it's hammer and anvil, the one that's about much like a football field. That's how I always remember it. And the mission itself was there were four objectives on the field, one in each deployment zone, and a total of two in the no man's land area. You won by having the most points that you could score at the end of the game turn. Each one was worth 1 point. There was also a bit of a twist in this, in that each of us had to have one character selected who basically, if he was killed, the game ended. Me,
Could you choose who that was?
yes, you got to, you, it had to be a character, but you, each person got to choose who theirs was for their army. Another thing, fun thing about the Open War deck is if there is, granted, it goes off, in this case, it goes off of the power level in this one spot, but if you've got a bit of a disadvantage, I don't remember what the exact number is. In my case, I think it was about 20 power level. You get a, it's called a ruse card, in which case the person who's got the lower power level gets a little special edition. The card I drew was basically Ehriman's old warlord ability. You could take up to three units and just kind of drop them on the field in a better place. In my case, and in this case, it was you had to be outside of the enemy deployment zone and at least 12 inches or more away. Kind of fun. Now, just to back up a little bit, I was playing my Thousand Sons. My list is Ehriman, an exalted sorcerer on foot, an exalted sorcerer on disc, two 10-man squads of Rubric Marines. All of them have the bolters. They've got the Icon of Flame and the Soul Reaper Cannon, if I remember right, it's called. I also had a 20-man squad of Zangors with the Zangor weapons. It's very useful weapon that allows for an extra strike, the extra strike. It's also minus one AP, which is a little bit different from the basic chain sword option. Honestly, it's not worth taking the chain sword pistol route. You don't want these guys shooting, you want them running in and charging into things. I also had a 10-man squad of the Scarab Occult Terminators. In this case, I kind of went all out on the upgrades. I had two with the Hellfire Missile Packs and two with the Soul Reaper Cannons. They're kind of my, I'm going to drop them in and try to wipe out whatever's in front of them. And then I ended up, I finished up my list with, of course, Magnus the Red. Adam was playing a Cadian army. Go through quite a long list. He's basically got a, he had a Lord Commissar, some infantry squads. I want to say he had like six of them. Each one was roughly about eight or nine models in the unit. He also had a command squad, which he filled up with las guns. This was a big thing. Anybody who plays Guard should listen to this. He played Hellhounds. Oh my god. I'll talk about those in a second. He also had three Basilisks, three Wyverns, I believe it's called a Master of the Ordnance. Yeah, Master of the Ordnance. And then, because it's a friendly game, I straight up said, I'm bringing Magnus. He brought his Baneblade. So, believe it or not, these are both 2,000 point lists. Oops. But at the end of it, I ended up with less power level than he did. Kind of go figure. But so turn one, I managed to go first. I dropped. I pretty much put Magnus right smack in front of the Baneblade because my mission was take that out first, or at least get it to where he's hitting on fives. I also dropped forward one of the units of the Rubric Marines, and then I held the Scarab Occult Terminators in Jeep Strike Reserve, basically. I'm hoping that he moves much of his army forward so I can just kind of pop him in the back and shoot him from behind. So, I drop Magnus in, I start throwing my smites during the psychic phase. I end up with about 3 points short of dropping his Baneblade down to the next level down. Okay, that's okay. I charged Magnus in. I managed to get him down to 14, which is, of course, that last little wound before he drops down. Not looking good. Take out two squads of infantry with my Rubricane Marines, because the nice thing about those guns that they've got is it basically says guard is just going to go splat. And then I tried to shoot a little bit of one of the Hellhounds. Only managed to take out maybe two wounds on it. So, his turn. Luckily, he for you know, looking back, luckily he forgot to move his Hellhounds. But he did not move anything with the exception of two units of infantry and the Baneblade. He pulled the Baneblade back. I'm still kind of remembering that you can do this. And then proceeded to focus on Magnus. Lucky enough that Magnus, after all these shots, was alive by five wounds. Which meant that he needed to shoot more stuff. So he proceeded to use the entirety of his army that could shoot at Magnus, at Magnus. That after all that was said and done, he still had to charge infantry at him. So he sent two squads at him and the Baneblade. So he decided to charge with the Baneblade. Attacks with yeah. So attacks with the infantry. The first squad of infantry gets in, the second squad can't get in just because the first squad got in their way. But he did leave enough space for the Baneblade to get in, and get in, and it did. The infantry did not put a single wound on Magnus. But the Baneblade ran him over.
Oh, no.
Yeah, so I lost Magnus at the top, bottom of turn one. He still had his Baneblade, but I was close to getting it down to where he was shooting on fives. So he finishes up his turn and go to me. I decide, screw it, I'm dropping down my Scarab Occult Terminators. I dropped them down next to the Rubricae that are closest to the Baneblade. And then I move forward with all my stuff, proceed to start smiting things. And then I make my second mistake. Instead of focusing on my Rubricae on the Baneblade, I start focusing them on infantry, and I have my Rubricae on the Baneblade, my Scarab Occult Terminators are on the infantry. I should have had it the other way around. I did manage to drop that one more wound to where the Baneblade was hitting on fives, and I took out two more units of infantry, but that Baneblade was still there. So, and then on the Hellhound, I was able to take out two more wounds on one of them. Not looking good for me. Granted, I had 2 points in the mission. He did not have any. So I was a little bit ahead there. And neither of us were really focusing on our characters that we could just flat out end the game with. Both of us, had models in between. Neither of us had anything that could with the sniper rule where we could just, you know, just flat out shoot them no matter what. Bottom of the turn comes out. He remembers to move his hellhounds. They end up right smack within range of one of my Rubricae squads, and this is when I find out just how hard they are. So, these things have the chem cannon. It's range 8, heavy D6. These are flamer weapons. But as long as it's not a vehicle, it wounds on a 2+.
Ew.
And is AP minus 3.
Really? I don't remember that.
Yeah. And what's more, 3 of them are 315 points. They're 105 points apiece.
Wow.
Watch out for these if you're playing against them. If you're playing the guard, why, and you don't have them, why don't you? Wow. So, proceeding on.
Do they transport as well?
No.
Okay, so you kind of push them forward.
You can also put another flamer on them, too. A heavy flamer. So,
there you go.
Yeah. These things have... If you're playing catachains or something where you can really use the flamer ability, yeah, run these. So on his second turn, he proceeds to wipe out my Zangors, which have only been able to take out a few guys in a unit. He takes out all but 4 of one squad of Rubricae, and he takes out one of my Scarab Occult Terminators. It gets to turn 3, and I realize this game is not going to go well for me. I start focusing more on the Baneblade, but I'm not hitting. You know, my dice kind of starting to go cold. All the 6s I rolled for the wrong things, let's be honest. So I start focusing more on the mission and trying to take out infantry to this one character where I can just end the game. The problem is there are just too many of them. At the end of it, he still has... had his the commissar he ended up selecting for it, his lord commissar and his master of the ordnance, he still had all of his tanks. So I was, and what I was left with was I had airmen, I had a few Rubricae, I had most of my Scarab Occult Terminators, and then I had both of my exalted sorcerers. He didn't need to do much of anything except for kill. And kill he did. On his turn, he took out airmen with the hellhounds. He finished off... He didn't actually have to finish off any of my Rubricae or my Scarab Occult Terminators. He managed to kill enough where when I rolled for morale at the end of the turn, they took themselves off.
That's an expensive roll.
Yeah. So the game itself ended on during the bottom of turn 3 when he finally just took out that the exalted sorcerer on disc that I had chosen for the secondary mission, basically. And then, just for good measure, proceeded to take out everything else. Because, let's face it, Basklis have a 12-foot range for shooting. And they could hit everything on the table. So, points-wise, technically, it ended up... you could say that I won by... I believe it's 1 point in the end for the original primary mission. But because of... A, I got tabled. And 2, there was that secondary mission that granted automatic victory. He did, in fact, win. Definitely a fun game. It took me, you know, a day or two to really figure out where I went wrong, but definitely something I'm ready to try out again.
So with the open ward cards, they're not like Maelstrom where you're drawing every turn.
Okay. So you do it at the very beginning before you put anything on the table. The deck itself is actually split into 4 groups. You have the... It might be 3. You have the deployment. There's missions. The twist. And then the ruse. And the ruse does not always come into play. If your point, if your po the power levels on the two armies are very close, that does not come into play at all. So you only use the first three. Some of the interesting plot, the twists. One of them is basically doubling their move, everything's movement. So you can end up with, we were talking earlier about Eldar. Can you imagine having Wraith Blades that have a 10-inch movement? It's
That
possible
would
on a
be
deep
sick.
decks.
Yeah, wow.
And, with them being, it's not an expensive buy, it's $15. If you're not playing a tournament and you're just, playing for fun to try a list out, I would say give it a shot. Tournament play, don't do it.
I keep hearing that, but I keep also hearing that there's certain elements within the open war deck that would be neat to incorporate into tournament play.
So as far as deployment and the main mission objective, I think it's fine. It's the ruse and the twist that I think you should avoid for tournaments. Things can just get too crazy. And of course, like I said, the ruse only comes into play if there is a more significant difference in the power level, and overall, tournaments don't really run off of power level.
That is true. All right.
So let's hear about the your game.
So, yep, I got a chance to try out some of the new ITC missions, and we talked about them last week. So before I get into that real quick, I had mentioned earlier the Warzone Atlanta missions, and they've updated since I last played them, so I'm completely wrong. But what I can tell you from just a quick glance, they are similar and themed to old 5th edition, but what things they've done differently is they have margins of victory as opposed to just an overall I beat you. So for example, with kill points, they have, if you scored this many kill points, you got this. This is your loss, win loss, how many points you got. So that's, I think, why you saw the point levels that we did in that Endurance GT. But if you're interested in checking out those missions, warzoneatlanta.com does have them all posted for your playtesting pleasure. So, Paul Murphy, sorry about that. I didn't get updated on your new missions. So, we tried out the new ITC missions. I played Aaron, who's a local ADMAC player in our particular area, one of our definitely part of the competitive crowd. I've played him once before, and the problem is when I get to the game store, it's usually later because I'm coming in after work, and most of the time is the terrain has already been picked over. So, the first time I played Aaron, we did not have any line of sight blocking on terrain on the table, and I got literally blown off the table. That was a fun experience. So this time we tried to make a couple changes, and worked out a lot better. But interesting with the mission, I was focusing very much on play to the mission. Aaron came with a very different approach, and where I was focusing on objectives, he was going to focus on killing. Inadvertently, my list was actually a perfect, kind of like when you play back in 5th edition, you have kill point denial lists. So you play like how few kill points I can put in my list. So I've got 9 kill points, you've got 22. I automatically win the kill point mission type thing unless you table me.
Was that really a thing back then? You got to remember, I didn't start playing until 6, so.
Yeah, that was definitely a thing. That was ridiculous. Because, yeah, I could look at, okay, how many kill points do you have? And if whoever scores the most kill points wins, well, there's only 9 in my list. And there's 22 or 16 in yours. I kill like 3 rhinos, you're already at, on your back foot.
Eesh.
So in this mission, I kind of didn't really think about that as strongly, but by my armies, pretty much I'm spamming as much of the minus one to hit. So I got a lot of Venoms, I got a lot of Razor Wing fighters, I took my double Ravagers, and then I also am spamming. I have 3 units that Deep Strike. 2 units of Scourges. Actually, I put 3 units in, but for some reason I misread my list and only brought 2. And a unit of Mandrakes. And the idea is to get the advantage when it comes to deployment and try to deploy later in the game and also hide them in reserve, which that part worked out pretty well. Anyway, rather than go blow by blow, because it really doesn't matter, what's interesting with the rules is you still. I misinterpreted a lot of the rules as being like the old Maelstrom from ITC. And my army was always built to win Maelstrom. So for example, you roll the 3 dice, pick the 2 missions, and usually entailed hold an objective, particular 1, 2, 3, or 4, or kill a unit. And so I would design my army around how well can I kill a unit. I only have to kill one to get the point. I don't have to wipe out this entire army. in one turn. Likewise, there was the triple play. I rarely went for that when it came to kills, unless it was something towards the latter part of the game when he had a lot of smaller units that have already been banged up. And when it came to hold objectives, I had a ton of mobility in my list, so I could zoom around and take advantage of turbo boosting at 48 inches with my bikes to get to any objective anywhere on the table. So fast forward to today, I'm looking at it, okay, I have a fair amount of Venoms, which are pretty quick. They can hold objectives, that should be fine. A minus one, that should frustrating for shooting. Right off the bat, I noticed that he was really frustrated with my list and choosing picking his secondaries. I only had two characters in the list, so taking the kill four characters objective, he's already losing 2 points to start the game. Wasn't happy about that. I had no units with a Titanic keyword, so that stratagem was gone, or excuse me, that objective was worthless. He ended up going with, I think it was Big Game Hunter, where he has to kill 4 units of 10 wounds or more. And that meant he had to kill both my flyers and both my ravagers to get that, because those were the only models I had with ten, where models were 10 wounds or more. He was going to also have to do death by a thousand paper cuts or something to that effect. So he had to kill 3 units in a turn 4 times, which was going to be hard for him to do, but also my, army's pretty paper thin. And if I forgot what his third one was. It really didn't come into play as much. It was kind of a throwaway. So as I'm playing, my goal is to hold objectives. I'm looking at his army with his with ADMech. He's got a ton of dune crawlers. He's got Call, and then he's got a truckload of Imperial Guard. And basically, he's rushing the Imperial Guard bodies forward. And I'm looking at it. He's going to try and stay back and stick around. Call is going to be centered of his army, and then he's going to form a fire base with the other dune crawlers and the unit of Castellans, which is exactly what he did. So as the first couple of units come up, I just, being guard, they evaporated pretty quickly to my long fire. I was able to outrange him for the first 2 turns. That worked out great. And then all hell broke loose. He anchored the Castellans, so that was like, okay, now's my chance, because this means he cannot move them, but they get to shoot twice. So my thought was, I've got all these deep strikers. If I charge him, he won't be able to fall back, and that unit won't be able to shoot for the rest of the game. Good idea, bad execution. The Mandrakes never made it through Overwatch. They just got, because he gets the fire twice, and he's got a volume, serious volume of fire. But as the game progresses, as I'm trying to figure out, so on turn-by-turn scoring, do you hold an objective? Yes. Did I kill a unit? Yes. So I would win 2 points. And then it comes to his turn, and it's like, okay, he actually had top of turn, and he goes, did he kill a unit? Yes. Did he hold an objective? Yes. But because he was going for that kill four units so many times, he was able to get a lot of more bonus points because he was killing 3, 4 units per turn, where I was only killing one. As the game progresses, I was starting to lose steam. They're running out of turns left in the game. So how do I get those points back? And so the only other way was to come out of my half of the battlefield and actually start challenging those objectives further downfield, or go after my secondaries. And that became much more difficult. So the fact that you have to choose your secondaries was a big part of the game and understanding how the game progressed. One thing I said earlier in today's episode was these 19-0 wins, these 10-10 ties. Those are pretty much going to go away with this mission set, because even in a losing effort, I was scoring points, and in some cases, lots of points. The chances of getting a tie when you have anywhere from 0 to 36 points is pretty hard. So that part was kind of neat that you can, because that's something that frustrated me, especially with my last 3 tournaments where I played some very tough players close. But for example, when I played Herb Schaefer last, I lost primary by 1 point. I lost Maelstrom by 2 points. And then he got two of his tertiaries. I got one of mine. So it computes to like a 17-2 loss. I'm like, I didn't lose that bad. That sounds like I got clobbered. Whereas this new rule set, you'll get a lot more points if you play it out. The other key thing is, though, there's a huge emphasis on, as they talk about in the mission design, getting to turn 6, because It's a turn-by-turn scoring. If you get to six turns, you get a lot more points than if you bow out in turn three or get tabled early on. So resiliency is another key thing, and that's something where my list was more designed for kill and scoot around. I just didn't have enough bodies left on the table. So I may go back to one of my older designs where I can get more board control or just a way to, play rope-a-dope and play to six turns like I used to in 5th and 6th edition to get those end of turn, end of game objectives. So it's a very interesting rule set, a definitely interesting mission set, and I'll say is give it a try, give it a couple more tries. It definitely takes some adjustments. Aaron made the same mistake I did when we talked about on the episode. He assumed you had to get each secondary once to get the full 4 points. No, you have to do it four times. You get one point each time you do it. So he was like, "Wow, these are pretty tough." And listening to the Frontline Gaming guys, going over those missions, they themselves said these secondaries were meant to be hard. And it's the expectation of maxing out 36 points in every mission is unlikely. So curious as we go through see these new missions get played, what is the kind of cutoff point? What is the high point, low point, midpoint for how many points you can score in a mission? And likewise, is there maybe a built-in sudden death where if I get to this many points, I can win the game no matter what? So it's going to take a lot more practice, but there's definitely a lot more thought involved in both in mission design, army design, but also strategy for the game.
Cool. I definitely have to start playing some of these missions.
Yeah, they're pretty neat. I think one of the things, yeah, that learning to, okay, how do I have a big turn, or do I, a big turn really doesn't propel you. I mean, it may affect end of game, but if he kills, like he was kind of frustrated, one turn he was able to like blow up a truckload of stuff. It still only got him one bonus point. So I was like, okay, I can take a heavy loss or make a mistake in one turn. If I can maneuver around that for the rest of the game, it won't kill me. Whereas like in a kill point mission, okay, you just gave up 5 kill points. You're dead. There's no coming back from that. So that was kind of neat to see. Same thing with objectives. Who can hold the objectives? Can you box out? The secondaries are pretty hard. Like the ones I took was aggressive recon or forced recon or something like that. I had to have a unit in all four table quarters, and I was like, okay, cool. If I do that once, I get ooh, 1 point. I have to do that four times. Ugh. But now with all my deep strikers and my infiltrators, that may not be that hard. I can probably pick up 1 or 2 points as they come in. So I got the guys in my area as well as my deep strikers in his backfield. I could pick up some points there. So all they have to do is survive to the end of the turn, and I start picking up points just for being there. So it's interesting. I think it'll be really neat. One of the other adjustments I think that was there's no warlord. It's kill characters or kill models, but there's no real meaning to warlord, which Don brought up to me is if you're playing Alpha Legion, that kind of stinks because that was a big deal. The whole I am Alpharius and that's my new warlord. It kind of diminishes that strength a little bit.
Yeah.
I still think there's still quite a bit of merit to that, but so yeah, it'd be interesting to see how this all plays out and play a couple more games with it. All right, guys, welcome back. We are here to talk about your ITC Top 10, and there's been some big movers and shakers, as we talked about at the top of the show. So let's start off with number 10. One time he was at number one, he's still hanging in there as a lone entry for the Tau Empire. Paul McKelvey at 598 points. He's about 82 points off the pace for reclaiming his throne at number one. In ninth place, Adrian Gennard playing Sisters of Battle. He's 73 points off the pace. Brandon Grant made up some ground. He's moved up to 611 points and about 70 points off the pace. Ian Andrew comes in at 7th place, 68 points out of 1st place. Sam Henley hanging in there at 66 points off the 1st place pace. So we got a whole bunch of clustered players here, 66, 68 points off, all within about 5 points of each other. Then we get some serious separation here. 5th place, Aaron Along. He's got a 10-point lead over Sam Henley and only 55 points out of 1st place. Tyler DeVries at 53 points out of first place, so he and Aaron are going to be tussling for quite some time. As well as, well, he's an old name, but we haven't heard much of him here in 2017, but he's back, and that's Matt Root, your defending ITC champion, is vaulted into third place, only 50 points out of first place. So between third, fourth, and fifth, 5 points separating all three players. Number two, we've talked about him a lot over the last few weeks, Andrew Gagneau, your current Captain America, at 18 points out of first place. That's right, he lost some ground to form his current teammate and your current number one ITC player, Nick Nottavati, with 681 points. Astounding at this amount, a number of points needed to be into the top 10 at this point.
I don't think I ever remember it being this high for first place.
You know, actually, funny you should mention that. I'm actually going to look at last year's stats while we're talking. But as we're looking at, all 10 players are at their maximum in terms of, you know, where they are, five events. So they're all ready to go. And it's also amazing to see many of your, I guess part of the success of 8th edition is that you're seeing a lot more players come out. So these, even the smaller events, which may be only one day events or more of your smaller GTs are now getting a little bit larger, they are seeing more players, so therefore more points are available. Remember, the more players that show up, the more points you get. So it's, you know, we're looking at a couple of the guys in the top, they're averaging 120 to 130 points per event. So it's not that they just had one big win. They got five big wins. Yeah, put this in perspective. I just pulled up last year's stat. Matt Root, I think they did it a little bit differently. Hold on a second. Last year had 843 points, so something's not right. So it looks like we had a little different scoring system back in 2017.
Ah. I do remember that they changed it. I just don't remember when they did anymore.
But yes, if you look at our top 10, most players are averaging 120 points. So not only are they winning big events, they're winning big events a lot, you know, five, six times. So pretty big deal. Good to see everything falling into place and glad to see a lot of movement in our top 10. But the key is, you know, we're in October at this point. We know there's usually a slowdown when it comes to the holidays, and then ramps up real big as a lot of people get some last-minute points before heading into the season finale at the LVO. So what events do we have got coming up next weekend?
So this next weekend coming up, we've got the Dragonfall GT 40K Championship at the Pheasant Run Resort in St. Charles, Illinois. The SoCal Open at the Del Mar Fairgrounds in Del Mar, California. Up in the northern areas, in British Columbia, we've got Kipper's Melee and Vancouver Island Convention Center in Nanaimo, British Columbia. And then finally, we have, you'll have to forgive me because this is not English, the Ka'akaua 2017 at the Four Pillars in Kailua Kona, Hawaii.
Wow. That'd be kind of nice to get out to Hawaii this time of year.
Yeah. So anybody who feels like traveling, go to Hawaii. Yeah, your significant other will appreciate the gesture, and you can still go to a 40K tournament.
That would be pretty cool. All right, so that wraps it up for this week. Thank you guys again for listening. As always, my name's Eric.
I'm Raymond.
And we'll talk to you next week on the Exterminatus podcast.